Okay, we'll get started. We have a quorum. It's 2 minutes past nine. And firstly, I wanted to welcome new members. We have a new member coming from Mana Whenua, who I don't think is with us at the moment or today, and that's Michelle. Michelle Terrell. And certainly, we'll do something more formal at our next meeting, which hopefully will be back in the boardroom. We also have two new board members joining the committee today, Catherine and James. Welcome. And
Thanks, Andy.
I also wanted to acknowledge those committee members who have very recently left us. One is Wendy from Mana Whenua, who'd only been on HAC for a very short period of time, but had been on our CFAT committee for many, many years. And I'm sure that Joe will acknowledge that at the next CFAT meeting. And also, having left the committee is Trevor Reed, who joined the HAC committee in 2005, which even predates me. And certainly, Trevor wanted to pass on his best wishes to you all and his thanks for the opportunity to have served on the committee. And I'm sure we value the skills that he contributed over such a long period of time. And lastly, I wanted to confirm the reappointment of Jan and Rochelle to the Hospital Advisory Committee for a further 3-year term. And thank you for your continued interest and commitment. This is the first HAC committee meeting that I've chaired via Zoom, and no idea how that's going to go, but we'll just play along and see how it goes. If I'm missing you from asking a question, do sing out. Very different meeting for us today because I wanted us to focus on just the two issues rather than our usual format. A review of the COVID-19 response and also looking at the board's recovery plan from that virus going forward. And I also wanted to acknowledge the contribution of everyone throughout what has been a public health emergency. And that's across our hospital services, our public health services, our laboratory services. Because I think New Zealand's response has been comparatively very, very good. And I think Canterbury's response has also been very good. And I think, I mean, I was looking at the UK today, 580 deaths per million people. That would be the equivalent of 2,900 deaths in New Zealand. So we've had 22 deaths, which is tragic, but our performance compared with many other countries has been really outstanding. So thank you to everyone involved. And of course, it's not over yet, and we can't afford to be complacent. So I'll move on to the conflict of interest register. No, I'll do apologies first, sorry. We've got an apology from Board Member Sally Buck. And an apology for lateness from David Mates, and an apology from Andrew Brandt, the clinical advisor to the chair. Are there any other apologies? No, thank you. I'll move on to the conflict of interest register. Does anyone have any additions or alterations to the interest register?
I'm sorry, he's not a clinical advisor to the chair, Andrew. He's a clinical advisor to the chair and the Crown Monitor and the board.
Thank you. Does anyone have
Andy,
a
I have a one change in my
Yes,
interest
Barry.
register. I've just become the chair of Ngāi Tuatahi's commercial arm, so I'll put that information through to Anna.
Great, thanks, Barry. Any
Okay.
other additions or alterations? Anyone have any interest to declare for today's meeting? Does anyone have a perception that someone else may have a conflict of interest? today's items? No, thank you. So move on to the minutes of the previous meeting. Are there any changes to those minutes? Could I have a mover from someone who was present at that meeting?
Happy to move, Andy.
Just make one change.
Yes, Rochelle.
It was the orthopaedic stuff about the increased BMI used for hip replacements and knee replacements. It says BMI of 60 plus, and I think it was a 40 plus, which was discussed.
Okay, we'll double check that. Thank you. Any other changes? I had a move of someone. Was it you, Barry?
Yes.
Yep. Andy. Thank you. So with that change, do I have a seconder? Someone who was present?
Yeah, Andy, I'm happy to second that.
Thanks, Jan. Discussion? Those in favour say aye.
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 Against? Carried. Thank you. So we'll move to the carried forward items, and there's quite a bit there, but if I can get the technology to work, here we go. A lot of them are carried forward to our August meeting. Also suggesting that the bariatric pathway, it says April there, that meeting didn't take place, of course. So I think we should, I'll talk to Anna and Carolyn outside of here about putting that on the August meeting. Carolyn, did you want to provide any verbal update on the two items there alongside your name?
On unmute.
That's all right.
Which two items? I mean, there's actually several items there with my name.
Yeah, but I meant for today where it talks about verbal update.
All right. So we've done some work, and maybe if we can bring it back to the next meeting, we've been doing some analysis around the over 75s attendance at ED during the COVID outbreak. During the COVID response, the all attendances at ED dropped significantly. The ones that have returned to their previous level are the over 65s. We've put in place a new program with age residential care. About 20 people a week have been coming from age residential care. And we learned during the response that access to after hours general practice was variable in age residential care, so we've built a new model platformed off the 24-hour surgery and our acute demand model to provide better access both virtually, so using virtual systems now, and also direct house calls for age residential care to see if we can moderate back that over 75, because the age residential care flow-in turned out to be one of the bigger drivers of that issue. So we'll be able to come back in a couple of months' time and see what impact the new model of acute response is having on that. The other thing that we managed to do during the lockdown is accelerate rapidly our advanced care planning. So again, a targeted and focused approach for older people and also people with long-standing chronic conditions such as chronic obstructive airways disease. So we almost quadrupled the number of advanced care plans and acute care plans that were undertaken or refreshed during the while general practice was in lockdown. So that's we know all of the people who've had those plans, so we'll be able to then monitor the impact on that and see. Particularly, we'd sent out a list of 950 people, a number of which are older people, with chronic obstructive airways disease who had been in our hospital. So we'll now be able to map that through and see if it has an impact on the flow from here. And the other one that was a verbal update is SP. So Ralph is going to deliver our recovery to planned care. Maybe if Andy, if I could then at the end of his presentation refresh some of the work we're doing around SP management.
Certainly, thank you. Any other points regarding anything on the carried forward items, both committee members and management team? I think there's a few that we're going to bring forward at the next August meeting, including the one that was deferred that was to be in our April meeting. Okay, thank you. So we'll move on. And I'm not sure if Sue, I can't see Sue on the line, is she? Do you know Sue's availability, Anna?
No, I'll just go and check.
Or shall we shoot into Carolyn's presentation?
Yeah, I think we might do that, Andy. I think Sue's tied up in the same call that David's tied up in.
Okay, let's do that if everyone's happy with that. So I'll move to item 5, the elective surgery recovery plan.
Thanks, and I'll introduce Ralph LaSalle, who's managing this plan, who will walk us through a presentation, and I'll add a bit more about the approaches we're doing to manage SP5, the patient pool, and our equity response. Ralph?
Great, thanks Carolyn, thanks Ralph.
Thank you, let me just share this on the screen with you. Apologies for those people that are coming in by telephone. You might not be able to see this. Can everyone see that on their screen, if they can? So, firstly, just thank you for allowing me to present to you today. I'm very honored, and I present on behalf of everyone who helped give me support and guidance while this was developed, to those that offered their ideas freely, and I present on behalf of the frontliners who actually brought all this to life. As I walked alongside of all of those people during this journey, I was inspired by their ability to share their strength and their unity of purpose, despite not always knowing what was going to come next. I found that sentiment embodied in a Maori Whakatuki proverb, and I wanted to share that reflection with you before we started. The proverb is, "Hei kai ki aku ringa," there is food at the end of my hands. It refers to the ability to use the skills and resources that we have to create success, and it's about being responsible for those resources and capabilities. We had a lot of language weeks in May as well, so to complete the language fusion here, it's also embodied in a Samoan proverb, soa leifau I leifau, joining the hibiscus fiber to the hibiscus fiber, which means unity and strength. And to complete it with New Zealand Sign Language, the sign for help similarly echoes the point of the Whakatuki. So I thank all of those people that had food at the end of their hands and were willing to share. As we move, the other thing I guess I have to say is that it's kind of daunting to do a presentation that everybody has in front of them. But I don't want to go through everything that's already there. So what I'll try and do is augment what you've already seen with some additional pictures or explanations. And I will go quickly through some of them, and I'll be happy to take questions at the end of them. So I believe it's everyone and everyone in the Canterbury Health System is responsible for preventing harm to our patients as well as ourselves. In the first place we looked when we were considering the restart of planned care in particular was to ensure we were properly managing clinical risk. And as you can see, we itemized 5 elements that must be in place to do that. So I've added a few just pictures into this presentation to help you see that. The first one was a consistent process to identify and assess a patient's needs. Now, first of all, every single patient that was on our wait list got reviewed because we didn't know how much capability and capacity we had during this period, and we needed to know who needed to go first. So when you, let me just get my spotlight up here. We're talking about this area right here. So each individual department looked at what would be considered an acute, what would be considered non-deferrable, and we had to split non-deferrable into those things that needed to be seen within 2 weeks and needed to be seen within 6 weeks. And then what could actually be deferred in this particular situation with a minimum amount of harm for the patient. And again, we looked at it from what could be done within, what needed to be done within 4 months and what needed to be, what could actually wait a little bit longer. We also put in place...
Note job found for copying.
Okay. We also put in place standard operating procedures for the Christchurch operating theatres, and these were adopted by all the private hospitals in Canterbury throughout our journey. We had an agreement from all the providers to work as a system, and to do that, we created different scenarios, and you can see how we moved from a hospital that's pre-COVID, and these are all the things that happened in the hospital system here. And while I talk about a hospital, please don't think I'm just talking about secondary care, because the headings up at the top could actually just be the whole health system. This is what we do in everything, but this is just pictorially for the hospitals. So we moved from a pre-COVID environment to a lockdown planning environment, and you can see that some of these things had to be take second place to training and looking at acutes coming through the system, and then who knows what was going to happen when we actually entered that COVID period, to a point when if we got to a point like New York or UK or whatever, we were going to be totally immersed in the COVID response. We set together a plan that included all the private hospitals, and I mean all the private hospitals in Christchurch, not just the ones that we typically deal with, of how we could make those resources, both human and facilities, available to us and what we were going to do. So there was clarity all the way about who was doing what and where. We did things, as we spoke about an equity lens on this thing, and just a few things that we did there, you'll see later on in the presentation. We actually took things out into the community that we don't normally take out into the community. We moved them out so that people could, it would be easy for people to get to. They wouldn't have to come to the hospital. They wouldn't have to be worried about getting into a clean or dirty situation. We widened access to accommodation support for those people that lived far away. If you don't know about it, NTA only supports people that live more than 100 days away. But we had people that just, even as far as Darfield or closer, they just actually couldn't move around the system. We put in place specialized taxis to make sure that when we did offer a service, people actually had the ability to come into our system. So when we looked at planned care, restart, we clearly defined how the hospital and the health system would switch between COVID and non-COVID environments. This is a brief outline of where we started and how we would do it. Wanted to just move on a little bit. Our actual planned care recovery didn't start until a week after this, but this was
Ralph. It would be really helpful if you could just tell us when you're putting something up, those of us that are on the phone, if you could just tell us what page you're on.
Okay. Hold on for a second. I will tell you we are on, on slide 6. Going to be a little bit difficult because it's I've added slides into this presentation.
I think Ralph and Joe, that would be page 4 on the pack that you've got, Joe, on Diligent Box.
Thank you.
Okay, I've only added in. I've only added in one more slide, Joe, so I will make sure that I point that out to you. So we're on page 4. This is the plan for week of April 20. for the wrap up. We gave our, I'm just including it here to show that we took every advantage to get ahead of the game on the restart. And again, note the work areas where we did relocate clinics to private facilities around the town. So BAPU moved to St. George's, Avastin Clinics moved to Southern Eye. I'm just going down to the next slide, which is planned care phased approach to surgery. So this is actually the plan that we came up with during the week of April the 20th and spanned over the next 4 weeks. We gave ourselves a stretch target this time. We didn't know when Burwood would open. We didn't know when level two would kick in, but we decided to go for it. We worked with the mobile surgical bus team pre-COVID, and we couldn't make it work at that particular point in time, but we said when we come back up on recovery, and maybe before you even are allowed to travel anywhere else, we want you in our system to help us restart the system. So mobile surgical services and the lithotripsy bus both provided us, well, mobile surgical services provided us 2 weeks worth of service at Rangiora, and lithotripsy came in twice for two days each week. So I'm moving down to the next slide, which is the planned care results. So how did that work for us? Well, I'd really be remiss in doing all the people who helped a disservice if I didn't take the tall poppy route here and say the result was amazing. If we add in the results from the week of the 25th of May, which was last week, over that 5 week period, we completed 1,852 cases versus a target of 1,890 cases for a 98% achievement. And I say amazing because we orchestrated that result over 8 different hospitals and facilities. Typically, we don't extend to that that much of an area. Our expectations post-COVID, due to things like physical distancing and patients staggering because room sizes aren't enough, aren't big enough, waiting rooms or recoveries on either side of the theaters, it's expected to be about 13 or 15% of throughput reduction. I'm going to move down to the next slide, planned care phase approach to surgery. So moving from now to the end of the year, we're continuing with the 450 cases per week target. I also want to point out that we're continuing with the new ways of working that we learned during the COVID period. One of them is a weekly meeting with the DHB staff and all private hospitals looking at the work we need to do and agreeing how to apportion it and where is the best place for it to be done. I'm not aware of any DHB in New Zealand that's created this level of trust, openness and transparency with its local private hospital facilities. This is something we continue to nurture. And we can see its long-lasting effects. So I've gone down to planned care and surgery, and where will we end up for the year? So planned care this year was broken up into three sections. The top section of inpatient surgical discharge was very similar to the old elective discharge portion from last year. We will achieve 90.3% of that total by the year end. The middle part of that was the minor surgical procedures, which is the new part of planned care, which includes things that are done in hospital inpatients, hospital outpatients, and the community. We will achieve 100% of those that total this year. And the non-surgical interventions were basically musculoskeletal interventions. We will achieve 50% of that, and that's because we work with ARA to get those through, and ARA has closed for a significant period of time during this period. So overall, not too bad given the circumstances. This is a new slide here, Joe, and I apologize for that one, so you won't have this one in your pack, but I've done planned care for a number of years now and for a number of boards. So as I sit here and try to think about what else is important for you to say, to understand and be able to instill trust and confidence that we've got this, we've got it. I wanted to show you one more thing. This is a snapshot of how we manage planned care. and the important thing I wanted to draw to your attention is the weekly variance to plan from both inpatient surgical discharges and case weights. For both volume and case weights, we were on or above plan for most of the year, up through about week 39 or 40, which was mid-March. We're on pace to achieve and really exceed the targets. So I hope that gives you a lot of confidence. We know how to make this work, and you know that we'll recover. As of last Friday, outpatient cancellations totaled 11,381 for the period, and we've seen 5,872 of them. So that's 52% have been through the system in the last 5 weeks. Inpatient cancellations totaled 1,158, and we've seen 551 of them. That's 48%. You can see on this bottom little chart here, it looks like we've had another Christmas. The only thing is that we don't normally plan things in our normal Christmas, and this time we plan things during this Christmas. So some similarities in what's happened, but actually quite good idea to know that we've done this before. We know how to come and restart a system out of Christmas to get back to where we need to. Just a little explanation on this chart as far as when I talked about what we planned for a capacity reduction moving forward.
Oh, Joe, just for your one there, that is slide 9, yeah. I think, on your back.
This is as planned care COVID capacity reduction. Thanks, David. This is how we determined that we're going to have a 13% on average reduction in throughput. So even though we're using 100% of the theater sessions that we have, what's ending up happening is with physical distancing and patient staggering, for example, on a list where we used to be able to get 4 patients through a 4-hour surgery list, we can actually only get 3 through now. So when you take that across our whole surgical portfolio, that works out to be a 13% average. Now, those high volume departments like ENT and eyes, MaxFax and things like that, that typically have 8 or 10 people on a surgery list, they're going to be hit with about a 25% capacity reduction. So the list will go ahead. It will show that our total theater utilization is fine, but we still won't be able to get the number of people through that we did before. So this is how that's been calculated. So that's the end of planned care, but before, I wanted to take you now through 2 other areas which are not part of planned care, but important to the system. One more slide. So this is just a summary slide, basically, that talks about the further constraints. This is called planned care surgery. We have physical distancing for a period of time for those first 4 weeks. We had one theater that was totally dedicated to COVID requirements in case we had someone come through with those requirements. The new practices that have been adopted, being more clinics using telehealth and telephone, new referral delivery system to reduce patient wait times, combined private and public hospital weekly meetings, and then of course any of the new practices that were planned and associated with the Hagley opening in 2021. So moving on to radiology, I'm going to go pretty quick through these last ones, but just to let you know that we had a restart plan for all of our services. Radiology aimed to get back to pre-COVID 19 waitlist within the 4 to 6 week period. It was supported just like the other services by extending hours internally, using the private system where we could. Again, a good fusion between the two of those systems. The constraints that we had in radiology were we were operating at max capacity before COVID. And any additional machine capacity that we had is in Hagley and not necessarily accessible at the present time. So COVID, and again, just outlining that high throughput modalities are likely to be impacted the most with physical distancing. At the halfway point of the radiology restart, we had done more than 50% of the work. At the end of the radiology restart, 4-week period, I believe we are actually on target. I will verify that. I tried to get with Sharon before this meeting, but I couldn't quite catch up with her. But I believe we are totally on board with that. And I also believe that she was able to do most of it internally with only a small amount of help from the private system.
Yep, so she's just sent us an update, Ralph, and you're absolutely correct. We delivered and, in fact, used the external support less than we normally would. So.
Okay, so now I'm on the slide that has oncology planning. And this talks about how we manage clinical risk and how we would do this. Move down to the individual portions of oncology. I'm on the slide now. It's pharmaceutical cancer treatments, or in the old vernacular, chemotherapy. Again, in oncology, like all the rest of our wait lists, we look through every single patient, and we different terminologies were used from patient cascades to other different things. But again, we looked at what patients, if necessary, could be paused in the system. I'm really happy to report that in chemotherapy and medical oncology, the patient cascade was not used. All patients were seen during the period. There was no backlog generated in medical oncology. There was a major change in the way we delivered services from face-to-face to telephone. When we look at the medical oncology clinics, this shows that we've talks about the telephone things, and the practices that we wanted to embed now are that we face-to-face is still important in certain situations in oncology, and we will use face-to-face appointments for any first appointment, any change of treatment appointment, and any change from a curative to a palliative care will always be done face-to-face. But we're going to try and move to all other ones will be done either by telephone or telehealth. Again, no backlog generated. Very big kudos to the oncology department for that one. And coincidentally, a survey was done in February, a joint survey between CDH Bay and SCN about the use of phone appointments. And patient acceptance of those was really good. They gave us some things to work on how we can actually make those better, but quite well accepted on phone appointments. Moving down to facilities issues in medical oncology. This is where it starts to get a little bit hard. And we're cramped. And you can imagine 6 palliative care physicians in one office. How can you do that in an environment of COVID where you need to stay 2 meters apart? You can't. So you have to split up the team into all the different places around the oncology building. In this case, we had to sacrifice the only meeting room. We had 14 registrars working in one office. We had to reduce that down to 5, scattered other ones, 3 SMOs sharing one office and not enough clinical space. They moved into clinic rooms. But now we've got a problem with we're using all the rooms in the facility, and we need to bring face-to-face people back in. The outcomes of this is that we don't have a meeting facility in the palliative care. We've got clinic rooms that were okay during lockdown, but now we have to figure out how to do that. We've moved some of the clinics from the chemo area or from the oncology area over to the Orange Building. But even the new technology is giving us fits, and I don't know how many Zoom calls you've been on in the past 5 or 6 weeks, but even when you're in the same office and you're utilizing either phones or Teams or Zoom, the electronic feedback gets too much. And our current facilities don't really allow even a 1-meter standpoint. So really great that we've got new ways of working, but they do not fit within the current physical space that we have. MDMs continued to work during the period. They actually switched from the MDM program that was developed by SCN to Microsoft Teams. Microsoft Teams is an environment like Zoom. If you don't know what Microsoft Teams is, and they found it actually so good that they're looking at how they can continue on with that. And as they restart, how they can open up the lecture theater, reopen the lecture theater with reduced capacities in this. On to the next slide that says medical oncology for inpatients. This is just a little bit of where we had to move people around and shift internally to make sure that we not only saw the people that we needed to, but didn't contribute to any ED loading during the period. Move the slide now to radiation oncology and LINACs. Again, we looked at all the patients and gave them a classification. And you can see the three slots that we've used. They're referred but not started, referred in the CT planning done, or a patient in active treatment. We moved to staff changes to three operational LINACs and looked at outsourcing. At one point in radiation oncology, we did have to pause 52 patients. At the time when we did this presentation, the Q4 that had been reduced to 12, and I believe we're all caught up with those now. We did have a non-COVID related breakdown of two LINACs, and we had one that was limping, which exposed vulnerability from getting parts from overseas and even getting repair people from Auckland during the period. Physical space is going to be a problem here again, and we expect a 15% reduction in capacity. I'll move down now to the next slide called outreach. Really great to see that we're able to continue chemotherapy in all the South Island locations. We did move to phone changes or change to phone appointments in most of those cases. Shuttle services was one area that we had a problem because shuttle services stopped and we had to still get people in to get them arranged, and we used specialized transportation for that. So in the end, we had a lot of wins and a lot of learnings. We saw all the patients during chemotherapy during level 4. Radiation therapy backlog is through the system now. Shifted service provision. We did actually have a bone marrow transplant completed with a donor from Rarotonga. So we had we worked with New Zealand Immigration, public health people in order to get that. And we actually have started to organize our first chemotherapy occurring on the Chatham Islands. So the learnings of this are that the new ways of working don't fit in our physical space. We'll still have a capacity reduction on physical distancing as we move through the COVID period. We've got existing problems with department facilities. Breakdown and repairs will require significant delays. When we do have SMOs that travel for our outreach, and when they do need to go to Nelson, when they do need to go to South Canterbury or whatever, or even the West Coast now with the reduced flights, it's going to take longer. So before, they used to fly to the West Coast in the morning, come back in the afternoon. Now there's only one flight over to the West Coast. So they're either going to have to drive, which makes them tired on a 3-hour drive each way, or they're going to have to spend more time. So that may limit some of this work that they can do at CDH Bay. We are working through a problem of overseas availability of stem cells for treatment. So that may mean that some of the bone marrow treatment options we had before COVID do not exist until things get better worldwide. And so that's really the presentation that I wanted to show you. I wanted to thank you for giving me the opportunity to present to you today. And for Joe Kane, I remember what you said last time. You can't see it, but there is a chocolate fish there, so I did bring chocolate for you. We'll courier it to you. Happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much, Ralph. Very interesting. questions of Ralph or Carolyn, did you want to jump in with any closing comments?
Thanks, Andy. I just, as part of the whole recovery procedure, we're running through not only the new referrals into the system, but we're reviewing those referrals that got paused in the system, and also looking at all of our long waits so that we can make sure that we get the people back into the system and with clinical priority. We're addressing particularly issues of equity where whether the response of the system hasn't been appropriate. We've done some analysis to make sure that our Māori, Pacifica and Asian populations were not adversely affected any more than the whole population was adversely affected by the pause. What we're seeing at the moment is that the reduction in access to our hospital-based systems was similar across the ethnicities, with the exception of Asian, which actually saw a significant, a higher reduction. But the recovery has been slightly slower for Māori and Pacifica, so we'll be addressing that directly through the work that we do with primary care to make sure that the right patients get back through the system faster. And that's all part of the process that we're now running, managing the referrals through the system. And as part of the planned care, which I was addressing the COOs this morning, nationally, as part of the planned care steering advisory group, that there's going to be a lot more effort put in to implement the policy that was signed off by this minister last year to get more activity happening in our primary and community setting, and also to specifically address equity, which some of the analysis is illustrating that one of the reasons that in some DHBs, and we still have to do the work here to understand it here, but in some DHBs, some of the delays for Pacifica relate to their higher level of complexity. They tend to come in with more comorbidities, and so therefore they get sidetracked in their path through the system. So it's about some of the things that Ralph has mentioned. It's about being deliberate about access, deliberate about timing, deliberate about transport, and taking a proactive approach when people did not attend to actually address the issues. There's a lot of work to go on in that place, but we're in a better position now than we were even a year ago in terms of the data and analysis that we have to be able to do this deliberately. And by implementing the virtual models that we've got now, we think we can actually do a bit of a leap forward.
Great, thank you. As someone whose care plan is delivered from Christchurch, Auckland and Melbourne, my experience over the COVID period was that everyone in the three centres was working really hard to make it work, and my care personally was seamless, so I have no complaints at all. The query I had was around patients who were waiting, and cancer patients who were waiting for, Ralph talked mainly about treatment, but I was thinking more of diagnostics, and they could be waiting for CT scan, for colonoscopy, for they could be waiting for surgery related to their cancer. What would be an example? A bowel resection, for example.
And most the non-deferrable surgery went ahead, Andy, so we don't think we dropped very much in that space. We're currently digging into the issues around the diagnostic end. So you're talking endoscopy, gastroscopy, etc. As Ralph has said, we've caught up on all of the radiology, so we're back on track on that. Our analysis shows that we were actually referring to the register the same number of people during COVID lockdown as we were at the same time last year. So we have a bit more work to do to identify whether there really was a significant gap. my biggest concern, given the rate of cancer in Canterbury, which is higher than the rest of the country, is how many people didn't arrive at their general practice. And certainly that's what we saw post the earthquake, is that when we did identify people with cancer, they were further through. So they were more complex. They were staged at a more invasive level because they hadn't actually stepped into the health system in the first place. So the 30 to 50% reduction in general practice attendance is going to be the biggest risk for us.
Thank you.
Can I just add that we had a bit of a lead time too before the national screenings restarted again, so we were able to again get on top of that, so that any wave that's coming through now as breast screening, cervical screening starts again, we'll be able to accommodate in our system.
Great, thank you. I'll open it up for questions. Just a reminder that we are in public meeting, and the meeting is being recorded and will be available on the website. But don't let that stop you asking questions. So I'll open it up for questions from any committee members.
I'll come in if no one's got their hand up.
Thanks, Jo.
Yes, thanks for the presentation, because it helped for a question I asked at QFARC. And I'm actually blown away by a wee bit, but I actually have to ask a question about page 9, which talks about the capacity reduction. And that was a lot to do with the physical distancing and those hours. Can I just have an idea of what's happening now? I mean, we've gone to 2, maybe to 1. I'm trying to get a sense whether we're still dealing with these reductions by, you know, distancing, or what is the plan 2 to 1 to? Can you just tell me that?
Yes, to some extent, we're still working through what level 1 means for us. But to some extent, the physical distancing requirements of even a meter between people still do give us fits. We may be able to pick up some additional throughput when we do move to level 1. But again, it's the congregation, the availability of spaces in recovery, and not necessarily being sure how long people will be in recovery, that we can't fill them up and continue at the same pace that we did before. So I think as we move to level 1, it certainly should reduce from the 13%. But if we do get another wave that comes through, it's going to be something we deal with until we have a vaccine for this, I guess.
So, Joe, I think further to what Ralph has touched on, there's two things, and it's a wee bit multifaceted, is theatre throughput will struggle to get back to 100% of what it was pre-COVID, and that's purely and simply to do with the physical issues, but it will reduce from the 13%. And as Ralph has touched on, there are processes being worked through to just remap and to look at how we mitigate the impacts of that. The other issue is the 6-bedded and 5-bedded rooms that we've got across Parkside and Riverside is just dealing with those. We lose or would lose about 66 beds across Riverside and Parkside, and that's not including another 15 that sit in the current ED component, that we cannot achieve a meter separation just on a good day. So that is something where the clinical standards and protocols have been revisited and re-looked at in terms of how we manage complex respiratory cases in particular in very confined spaces that are contrary to what would be seen as good practice. So that capacity is going to remain a part of our landscape, and quite how and where we land with that is still being worked through, and will take a wee bit longer to get fully landed.
I guess that irritates my question then, is how we manage to do this. I mean, it is it is actually a very good news story. So can I ask the next question is, the theatre capacity, would this be similar in the rest of New Zealand, or are we, again, an outlier? Because I don't want us to be an outlier. And the same with the beds. I mean, we had constraints beforehand, so this will make it worse. But is there some joint working in New Zealand? I mean, they can't expect, if they're asking level two and level one still to do that and you've got constraints in your hospitals. But can I get a sense how the rest of New Zealand is dealing with this?
We're obviously theatre constrained, so it hits us quite harder than other areas that might not be. So in other areas where they have plenty of theatre capacity, they can still get the throughput by opening up additional theatres that may not be resourced now at their level, but they have the ability to do that. For us, we've indicated that it most likely will mean more outsourcing until we can get into Hagley, where we have a bit more resource.
I think, Joe, it would be fair to say that across all of the larger district health boards, there are significant challenges with both catch-up and how that will be delivered out over the next 12, 18 months. A number of the smaller DHBs, it's less of an issue. And that's purely and simply to do with the type of cases they're doing and the capacity that sits in those areas. So that's so there is a difference that sits both size and also the larger district health boards have got a disproportionately bigger challenge sitting there.
I think the other thing to add to that, David, because as part of the plans, care steering advisory group. You know, we talk about these things on a regular basis. We do have the advantage, Joe, that this is the upside downside, because of our long-standing theatre capacity constraint, our way of working with the private sector is well and truly embedded. And the work that Greg Robertson and Ralph did during the lockdown to cement that process in place meant that we're better positioned than most other DHBs to use the private sector as part of our recovery.
Yes, thank you for that. I guess I wrote down a word when I was reading this, and I don't understand how we got back up to those, you know, percentages so quickly. And I wrote down a word, slick. And I was thinking of the throughput that you have to do when you have reduced capacity, but it also shows that obviously the new way of working gives you opportunities to do things a little bit differently. And I think it's quite clear that what we have to do, once we understand two and one, that there is a paper that must come about the new how we're going to do new ways. I mean, just going back to throwing people back together close in wards and what have you isn't optimal. You may not have any choice, but I'd like to see that next piece of work that will come about, lessons that were learnt here and where we were able to optimise some areas, and that we keep doing that, you know, that we make those changes, because it's actually, you know, I it was a very slick result, I have to say.
And I note that the Crown Monitor has talked a number of times at board meetings about the impact on productivity of the way we now need to work in the COVID environment. So that's definitely an issue going forward for everyone, public and private sector, amplified in Christchurch because of our physical constraints at Christchurch Hospital particularly. Other questions?
Just on the part of Joe's question as well, just in regard to the reduction in service provision, that 15-13%, you mentioned that there's some extended hours in some areas. Is this right across, or is there capacity to potentially do this in other areas to reduce that reduction in service as well, or is we kind of maxed out in all of our extended hours?
I think the answer is that there are different departments working differently. Where they have the capacity to do it, we wouldn't necessarily want to do what we did in radiology full-time forever. That puts a lot of pressure on staff, and they do need a break. There are some groups, gastroenterology is working one additional Saturday a month, and have been doing so for the past 2 years to maintain their wait list. So that I think it's variable across there, and it's also dependent upon the facilities and the abilities that we have internally to do that.
I think some of the issue too, Naomi, is that there probably are opportunities and we'll exploit all of them, but we have also been able to take advantage of the fact that people couldn't travel for their CME. So that has the other impact, is that because people have been staying and doing the work, then we've had an increase in our annual leave balances and a few other things. So it's actually trying to balance the workforce costs and the annual leave and all of the other things to get it right. So it's a tricky equation. But certainly the plan that we've got going forward, we will be actively planning to catch up and mitigate that 13%.
Thanks. And yeah, that is a great result. I don't mean to take away from that.
It is probably also, looking at a patient side too, there was some work done on this, that some patients don't necessarily respond to extended hours as well. So we've got to actually take that into account as far as how we do this. So short, sharp bursts of some of this to get back to a new normal probably work, but before we say that is the new normal moving forever, we need to take that into account.
Okay, thank you. Any last questions? Can't see anyone there, so I'll move on. And our presentation now was item 4, COVID-19 update from Sue. Sorry to keep you waiting, Sue.
That's all right. Sorry that I was late. David and I were dealing with the remnants of the ECC Coordination Centre response, which is the isolation quarantine facilities, which we're having to step up again in the next week, and are probably going to be very big over the next 6 months. But what I thought I would do is give you just an overview of the activity, because I think questions were being asked and raised about what we were doing when the hospitals were quiet. But the fact that we didn't have a huge influx of COVID-19 patients didn't mean that we could be able to plan for them. And there was a phenomenal amount of planning and organising that went on. Ralph's talked about some of that went on, as well as moving towards the future in the acute and planned care. But we had to assume that we were going to get inundated with cases as they have in the States and Western Europe. So that meant a wide range of activities from every single service to plan to be able to do it safely. So what I have done is I've asked services to put together, well, half a page, which varied between half and eight, pages in the report that summarises what they did over that time. And I thought that what I would do is I would talk to you a bit about our emergency coordination response. And I got asked some questions by Canterbury Clinical Network to answer, and so I put the answer to those on some slides because I think that they're relevant. So what I might do, if I can successfully, is just share the screen, although it is on your it is the boards as well. Sorry. Have you got the slide, or have you got my have you just got one slide, or have you got more than that on your screen?
So what you've got up there is the Emergency Coordination Centre Priorities Learning Transition.
Oh, good. Okay, thanks. Something else has appeared on my screen to confuse me. So in New Zealand, we operate in an emergency situation under the SIMS structure, which is a coordinated incident management structure. Every single agency sets up in this same format. That means that everybody knows who to talk to in each agency about what particular issues arise. So the police do this, civil defence and health, certainly all relevant in this case. So we set up early in February a virtual ECC, and over time I've put the timeline in the paper. We ramped up to a full ECC structure. What we had in that was, what I'll do is actually just go to this next slide. Sorry, my system's not working very well for me here. So this was the questions that I was asked by the Canterbury Clinical Network, which was a brief overview and how the priorities were changing to transition to a new normal, although we're trying to talk about a new normal, to be honest. What our key learning and observations were and what changes that have occurred through the COVID response. So just to...
So your voice quality, you're breaking up a wee bit?
I don't know what to do about that. I'm talking very loudly into my computer. Sorry.
Carry on, Sue.
On full volume. So, in the incident control, in the SIM structure, we operate with a, I hope I've got it on the screen here. So we have an incident controller, but we also have a huge number of functions that sit under that controller. We have a planning and function, intelligence, we have operations, logistics, welfare, and a public information management system. And underneath those systems sit a whole lot of work streams. And as you can see along the bottom of the slide, we had 10 emergency operation centres running. So each of our services ran one. We had one with ISG, one with labs, as well as all the hospital sites. And so all that planning and a lot of the things that Ralph was talking about came out of those centres, with key clinicians working with their managers planning what needed to be done, whether this be a... planning on expansion of ICU, or setting up particular infectious diseases streams to look after the COVID patients, a whole range of things. So a brief for this, we set up an action plan over the whole of the system and asked people to contribute to it, and our objectives were that we had a workforce that was able to meet demand. And again, we had to plan for high demand. We didn't know that we were going to be sitting as low as 38% occupancy within our hospital. We had to protect and support the well-being of the health workforce, and this is not just physically looking at PPE and how we manage that, but also psychologically. We had a lot of really scared people at the beginning of this. They could see that their colleagues and friends around the world had... got ill, or in fact some of them had even died. We had to make sure that we maintained our central clinical service delivery, and Ralph and Karen were talking about making sure that we didn't defer non-deferrable surgeries, so that people with cancer got their surgery, for example. We had to have special access and security for the facility so that not anyone could wander in and out. We had to make sure that essential services were maintained, that vulnerable people were supported, which actually turned out to be possibly the biggest thing that we had to do. and we had to reduce the physical, psychological and social consequences of the pandemic, which is under health's brief. So these are just the sites that are on the chart where we had our focus of work, and somewhat to our surprise, our biggest amount of work was with the aged residential care facilities. I don't know why we're surprised looking back, but of course we were all about intensive care and our medical wards and keeping our staff safe from that perspective, whereas the most vulnerable sites are the aged residential care facilities, and that's where you will be aware of Rosewood, but there are other facilities that we had to focus our work on and had to help staff. So as we worked through it, we found that, as I said, our priorities changed when we were looking to the future. And I think one of the key things that we discovered was the importance of public health. I mean, you'll be aware that in the States, Donald Trump reduced the CDC funding and the point was people sitting around with nothing to do, just planning. And we realised, I think it's become obvious to all, that the importance of a public health response in something like a pandemic, but also in all of our health responses. The other thing that became particularly clear was, unfortunately, we're at an advantage in Canterbury because we already have a whole system approach. But this whole system approach has meant working with the police, with the defence, with civil defence, as well as our usual health partners. And we all had to work together to cooperate. Also, the importance of looking after our staff. As I mentioned, we had quite a few frightened people. We had quite a few people who didn't want to work in COVID areas, people who didn't want to come to work, people scared about their future. And I think that we really highlighted the focus of how important our staff are. In this kind of situation, we expect them to rally around, work phenomenally long hours, actually put their lives at risk for the public. And we need to appreciate that. But the other thing that, again, it's been part of the Canterbury philosophy is that we support people to look after themselves. And we found that throughout this time of reduced services, people could probably look after themselves better than we'd anticipated with just a bit of support. And that's one thing we learned with the phone support, for example, that often that's all that people actually required. So I was also asked in this CCN about the key learnings and observations, and I it's something we know in Canterbury, but the relationships are absolutely key within the health sector, but with our wider sector partners as well. Another thing that rose was the importance of business continuity planning. Now, we've had a business continuity planner in our service continuity team now for well over a year, who had a lot of trouble getting any services traction to taking their need for this seriously. Those that did have good business continuity plans in place found it a lot easier to respond. Those that didn't had to develop them extremely quickly. I think equity was another issue that we've all been talking about, but in an emergency response, people tend to forget about equity. They do things as quickly as possible, and that often means not factoring in our more vulnerable populations. And we found that in some of our responses to setting up CVACs that we've learned a lot, that we could have done a lot better in the future. But also in our overarching planning response. We've also learned, of course, we've been highlighting already that primary care can be done very differently. And everyone's talked about telehealth, but we picked up telehealth in a very ad hoc way. Everybody became rapid adopters, but we now need to look at what this actually means, what constitutes telehealth appointments, how we manage them, what platforms we use, what training people need. We also agreed that follow-up isn't always needed, but we're probably doing more than we needed to. We kind of knew that, but this has put it into sharp relief. Ralph talked about using Zoom for MDMs, and we've found that that has made things a lot, not just leaner, but more efficient. And we've often got regional people involved in MDMs, and people certainly who work all over a Canterbury health system. And by enabling this to be done with technology, has been actually a vast improvement. But the other thing was the importance of social contact and how everybody actually got really, really sick of Zoom and Teams and was craving face-to-face contact by the end of all this. So this is stating the next, same thing, a slightly different way, but what changes have occurred should be retained. And I put in proper use of the technology, efficient use of GP time, types of the need for follow-up, business efficiency with the use of the technology, but also increased awareness of public health messaging. I think hygiene is a really big one. I'm not sure that we've been locked down long enough for people to actually change their what we're calling hygiene habits. Back in 2009 with the swine flu, there was a study done with people following people around looking at their hygiene habits, and even in the middle of that flu outbreak there was appalling hygiene practices. Also better cooperation across the health and disability sector, and one thing we became aware of when we're dealing with the ARC facilities is that the disability support services have slightly been left out to one side. So for example, we were going and looking at infection prevention control practices at all the ARC facilities, but no one had looked at the disability provider services because they're in a different stream. And so we started to do that and rolled that out as well towards the end. And I've also mentioned the need for occupational health and focusing caring for our staff. Of what I have to say, but I'm very happy to take any questions.
So I think you've put your emails onto shared this email screen. You need to go back to Zoom.
I've got two screens here, which is causing me no end of problems with me. Fix that now. Sorry, am I still showing you a blank screen?
Yes, you are.
Okay, if you'll just bear with me and ask questions while I try and get that under control.
So if you just click on the bottom of your share screen at the bottom and it should unshare it for you.
I know, but I don't have it, you see. It's completely shut down into a tiny space and I can't, I don't know what's happened. I can't undo it.
I'll get someone to pop down, Sue.
Karen's coming to rescue me.
Thanks, Sue. And sorry about that. Some reason I got kicked out of that meeting, but I'm back. Here we go.
Sorry, it was my two screens confused me completely. Karen's just saved me.
Thank you. Very good. So I had a query about when this issue first came up, or when it became apparent that we might be looking at a global pandemic rather than an isolated incident in China. One of the concerns that was raised was about intensive care capacity across the country. And that was a concern we had in Christchurch as well, with the Hagley building not being open. And I just wondered if, as a result of this experience, if there were any moves to look at that issue nationally. because I think one of the reasons we had to go so hard and so early was that there was concerns about our intensive care capacity and our ability to cope as a nation.
Yes, as a part of the planning, there's been a national ICU group formed that's been looking at that. To be honest, I've lost visibility over what they're actually doing right now. They were the ones responsible for bringing a whole lot of ventilators into the country. Locally, you'll be aware that we were trying to move, see if we could move into Hagley early, because that would have solved a lot of problems. Wouldn't have been a possibility, but we'd also looked at it to expanding into Ward 10 and 11, so we actually had the equipment to do that, but we didn't need to, obviously. So yes, there is a national group looking at ICU capacity. We've had a South Island group for some time, which we've been trying to turn into a national group. So we're quite pleased that this has opportunity presented itself, but I'm not sure where they're at.
Mm. So Andy, just further to that as well, and to further to what Sue was saying, that there has been a lot of planning nationally, and probably behind the eight ball relative to the number of ICU beds and ventilators that people thought was required. I think learning from the international experience, ventilation has not always been the most appropriate treatment for a lot of patients. In fact, high flow oxygen has been much more effective in many jurisdictions. It doesn't require ventilation. And so a lot of the, again, the expert advice and thinking over the time too has changed how some of the responses would occur. Also the importance of effective both primary care and community isolation has really been really, really important in the context of New Zealand. So as Sue touched on, we had the ability to step up a number of areas with additional ICU capacity and or oxygen, high flow oxygen. And it was absolutely fantastic not to have to be put into that situation of having to test that.
The Crown Monitor made a comment the other day, which I really agree with about, I think it was something like that with success, your biggest danger is complacency. And certainly New Zealand has been extremely successful in its response, but we definitely can't afford to be complacent. And the comparisons often made with Australia, how well they have done, and they have done well. Today, they have 487 active cases in Australia, and we have one. So still a lot of risk out there. And I guess I wanted to be reassured that we were ready to ramp up if we had to.
Yes, we're ready to ramp up if we have to the level that we managed to increase our capacity by. But there is still the potential of being overwhelmed. I mean, as a country, we are not as well off as many other countries. And just with David's point about high flow oxygen, the problem with that is that you need negative pressure, or you need to have very, very controlled situations to manage that safely, and certainly currently our ICU is not set up in that way at all. So we can ramp up again very, very quickly, but I think like any health system in New Zealand, if it did get out of control, we would be overwhelmed. But I think we just have to be confident that with contact tracing and very close border controls that we won't get into that situation again. I mean, I think we've done astoundingly to get to this point. I wouldn't have thought it was possible.
Agreed. So I'll open it up for questions.
Hi, not really a question, just I guess a few comments. I mean, obviously the system, there was a lot of planning. We weren't really tested. And I think you're right. So when it comes down to it, it's the public health service that's going to be what safeguards the hospitals from getting overwhelmed. And we seem to be improving that area. I just wanted to commend Kirsten's team and the laboratory services, because I think they've done an amazing job reading the report on that. They were up and running very early and have obviously supported other areas. So just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah, yeah. Really amazing job.
I think what's really important is that the lab's job isn't done in the same way that community and public health job isn't done. Community and public health are having to ramp up to be able to contact trace 67 people a day. We're starting to get flights into Christchurch again from the 15th of June, which will require community and public health, but also now we're being told that all these people need to be swabbed on arrival and one time further along. So if you get in a couple of flights in a week, that's probably 200 swabs a throw. So these things aren't going away. In fact, I think the isolation quarantine facilities are going to be a pretty big deal going forward.
And that's the dilemma and the challenge, really, because while we all want to open up our country, the biggest risk to our country comes from outside. We're now 99% confident that there is a community transmission. So the only way this can take off again, really, is from the outside. And as soon as we get external flights coming in, and as soon as we get large gatherings, particularly very large gatherings, then obviously that's where the risk is going forward.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Thanks, Rochelle. Any other questions? I also wanted to acknowledge the people who are doing the pulling together the situation reports on a daily basis, both the DHB and the Ministry of Health. And I don't know who those people were, but the information there was very succinct and timely and useful. And I thought it was very good.
So just to let you know the process, each of the EOCs will send in a sit rep daily to the ECC, and some of the planning function will pull those sit reps together.
And Andy, the summary that the board received was a very high-level summary. When you look at the detail, as Sue touched on, that was coming through from each of the EOCs down to really micro-detailed planning, right through from the primary community through to labs, Ashburton rules, the main hospitals. So, again, that's percolating through in terms of the really core issues and core points to be highlighted.
So the level of detail even surprised me when we had to start to think about the deceased person's pathway and how they can do it. Fortunately, we've got really good people who know how to do all this, and everyone just phenomenally pulled together and sent all the information up through the system.
Could I come in, please, Andrew? I've had to come in a different way.
Of course, Joe.
Sorry, yeah, I don't know what's going on. I think whoever the controller is muted me. great report, thank you. So us board members were really lucky. We got the SIT reports every day and communication was really good. But when I got to the end of your report, which was really great, because what I want to see is where we've got this new word, accelerating the future. And you've got a number of bullet points there and the piece of work, the key learnings and observations and what changes and how can we adapt. And because I'm kind of blown away by the productivity that actually has happened during and after, I don't know, that I'm going to be really interested to see how the rest of New Zealand has done that, given our constraints. I guess who's going to lead this kind of piece of work now that that we need now to ensure that the gains that we've made, the adaptations that we've had to make in our constrained sites and how we can work better. And as I said, we've used the productivity word today. This is a key piece of work. Is it going to sit? I just want to get a sense of picking up how we can monitor this, ensure that we keep the traction going.
Well, I've been having that conversation with David, actually, and some of it, as you know, from what Ralph and Carol have been talking about, has well on the way and been started and being led by them. But we do still have a piece of work to finish to pull together how we're going to have oversight of some other aspects that need to be progressed.
So again, just Joe, further to what Sue's touched on, you're seeing some of the elements emerging anyway. As Sue touched on the plan care, what Ralph has kind of talked through is an absolutely complete byproduct or an outcome coming through from this of how to lock in a range of different elements. But that is one aspect of a wide range of things that actually through the ECC framework have been identified. And what we're looking to do is how that gets cohorted into and leveraging off the existing infrastructures that we have within the Canterbury Health System, as opposed, and that's a moving from that emergency response to a what we're calling accelerating our future component and pivoting resource and focus within the organisation to accelerate a number of those elements. So some of them are simpler and much clear cut. There are a few other bits that we're needing to work through to make sure that we arrive at the right outcome and that has been able to be delivered. But the challenge that all health systems have is there's a window of opportunity. And the longer it goes on without embedding, or locking in some of the changes, the likelihood of losing the opportunity gets higher.
Thank you, because I saw two other points, because if we didn't pick up, and I almost think, maybe I'll send an email to the chair about using that word, accelerating the future. Working with our communities was a critical point, and clear messaging was also a critical point in taking our community and our partners with us. And I'd like to see, that we pick up that traction and ensuring that why is it our community did so well? Why is it? And that's because, I mean, I actually, give some kudos to the government here. I think the clear messaging that they gave at the top to the community so they could understand. But I'd like to see that working with the community, working with our partners, which we've already talked about, the private partnership, but there's plenty more, GPs and what have you, and the clear messaging is in how we lead these new projects. Because it's kind of, I know that we've looked after the earthquakes and all those times at how we've really been able to provide exceptional service. But this was quite different, and I think we need to pick up and run with it.
Thanks, Jo. Other questions of Sue? No, I can't see anyone.
Can I just make one other comment, because I was just thinking about Rochelle's acknowledgement of the lab, because I'd like to also acknowledge our infection prevention control team. We have a governance team which includes infectious diseases, community public health, general practice, and our labs infection prevention control, and they have been absolutely phenomenal in their advice support to the whole of the health system, not just our hospitals. Two or three years ago we went to this position to have such a fantastic team, and we're very relieved that we have them now. They've been absolutely amazing.
Great, thank you. I mean, it really was a team effort, wasn't it? I mean, just as important were people like the cleaners and the laundry workers who play a vital role in infection control. So it really was an integrated response across the whole health sector. But it's not over.